I invite you to stand and join in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please call the roll.
Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer?
Here.
We have minutes from the regular council meeting of March 21st, 2016. Are there any corrections? If not, may I have a motion and a second for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Any corrections to the agenda?
Mayor, I'd like to remove R3516 from the consent agenda and put that into new business.
Any others?
I'd like to remove R3416 from the consent agenda also to new business.
Mr. Mayor, I would like to remove, R7616 off of the agenda as well.
We have a citizen request for 75, 76, and 77.
Where does 16 go? Is that new business or old business?
The bills 75, 76, and 77 will be old business.
Okay.
34 and 35 will be new business.
Correct.
Are there any other changes to the agenda? If not, may I have a motion second to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
We have several opportunities during the meeting for public comment, after public hearings, after old business, new business. And at the end of the meeting, there is an open comment section where any member of the public can speak for 3 minutes about anything. Each individual is entitled to 3 minutes. If you represent a group that is principally involved in an issue, you may ask for and will be entitled to 5 minutes. It's a pleasure for me and an honor to present the 8th Annual Howard B. Lang Jr. Award for Outstanding Volunteer Service to the City of Columbia. The Howard Lang Award was created by Leo Hill, who was Columbia's first city manager. He worked with Howard Lang, who was Columbia's mayor from 1953 to 1957. Manager Leo Hill created the award to honor both the memory of Mayor Lang and to honor someone selected annually who is recognized for significant volunteer activity, impact, and initiative in support of the City of Columbia and its mission. Normally, Howard Lang's daughter, Keke Westerfield, is here for the presentation, but unfortunately she is ill tonight, and this is the first time that I've presented this award, and she's not been here. Honor to announce that this year's winner is Marianne McCollum, a former mayor of Columbia and a wide-ranging city volunteer. She is the recipient of this year's Howard Lang Award. Marianne has served Columbia for many years. She served as Ward 3 City Council Representative 1985 to 1989. She was mayor from 1989 to 1995, and she has been a significant member of the highly effective Columbia Housing Authority Board of Directors since 1997. When she was on the City Council, Marianne worked to improve Columbia's economy, and she championed civil rights. Many of the hallmarks of Columbia's life find their origin during the days of Marianne's service and her mayoral term. She helped secure donations to establish and build the original Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and she served on the Martin Luther King Memorial Restoration Committee. Marian McCollum formed and chaired the inaugural committee for the annual Columbia Bayou's Diversity Celebration. In cooperation with the University of Missouri, Marian helped plan the opening ceremonies and reception for major donors of the first Show Me State Games in 1985. She helped develop the Columbia Wetlands Project, an ecologically sound method for treating wastewater while providing wildlife habitat. And among many others, Marian McCollum created the concept and then served as a member of the task force that formed Columbia Regional Economic Development Incorporated, or REDI, as is now commonly known. Much of Marianne's current city volunteerism is through the Columbia Housing Authority, where she serves on the board of directors. In that role, she works to improve housing and housing opportunities for low-income citizens to make residences safer, more efficient, better maintained and equipped, and most importantly, to create an environment that leads to self-sufficiency for this diverse population. Regarding Marianne's term as mayor, no one knows better than the few of us who have served in that role how demanding, time-consuming, and sometimes frustrating, but always how exciting and rewarding mayoral service can be. So thank you very much, Marian, for your excellent volunteerism to the City of Columbia. This is a plaque which says Howard B. Lang, Jr. Award for Outstanding Volunteer Service to the City of Columbia, presented to Marian McCollum, in recognition of your dedication to the Columbia community. Marian. Wait. A cash gift of $1,000 goes along with the award, and Marian has asked that this gift go to Patriot Place to establish a dog park, helping it to make it a home for veterans and their furry companions. Thank you, Marianne. Marianne, do you have any comments?
Thank you very much, Mayor McDavid, and City Council, it's great to be with you here this evening. When I first heard about this award and that I was going to be the recipient, I was just, first of all, totally shocked, and I can tell you I stand here tonight totally humbled and honored to have been chosen to receive this. I thank John Baker and the selection committee, and also Khaki Westerfield. She has always been a person I truly admired for all of the work she has done over the years. And I know last year at the presentation, Jeannie Rogers did such a wonderful job about talking about former Mayor Howard Lang, and I just feel so honored to receive this award tonight. If I might take just a minute and make a few introductions. I looked back, and people are like, what? It was 27 years ago tonight, April 4th, 1989, that I was elected mayor. So it kind of brings back a lot of memories on that. And actually, I left office, and Darwin Hindman is here tonight, that replaced me as, or came in as following me as mayor on April 4th, 1995. So, and in August of 1994, when I was still mayor, I was very, very fortunate that my baby sister, her husband got transferred to Columbia, and they're here with me tonight, my sister Julie and her husband Ted. And they have, when I look back, and I think, oh gosh, I was old. Being mayor ages us, right, Dari? I was 45 years old when I left office. And so that, yes, I'm 66. That has given me a number of years to continue working in public service. And while in office, I did have the opportunity to meet so many incredible, passionate, dedicated volunteers. And so after leaving office, I decided this was something I wanted to continue doing to give back to my community. And I especially want to thank Phil Steinhouse, our current CEO at the Columbia Housing Authority, and Jeannie Rogers, our current chair of the Board of Commissioners, who was my first appointee. It would have been 1990. I appointed her to the board. And it is such a privilege and honor to continue serving now on that board and to have Phil as our CEO along with my fellow commissioners. I also look, and I see a former recipient, Key Groshong. With over the last 20-some years, can we count the ballot issues we've worked on? Water and light, sure, parks. I even served on a committee, thanks to Ted Boehm, for the jail. And I currently, how do you say no to the presiding commissioner? I'm on the committee for, or the task force, excuse me, for the fairgrounds. Ann Moore was here a little bit earlier. The USS Columbia Committee continues today, and Mayor McDavid mentioned the diversity breakfast. And Georgia Liu, I know my first cohort with that, helped establish that and get that. And I'm so pleased and proud that it continues today. But looking back over the past two decades, one person who has been a constant support for me in all of these, and is like, why do you keep doing this, has been my friend and companion, Larry Stevens. Larry, thank you. The mayor mentioned the most recent project we've taken on with the Housing Authority, and that is Patriot Place. It's soon to open. 25 one-bedroom apartments. But those of you that have known me over the years know my love for animals. That's no secret. When I became mayor, we had Punky, the first kitty of the city. Remember Mr. Back? And some of the things you've all humored me with. And I do like dogs. And with Patriot Place, there was, I think, one thing still missing. Phil and I talked. And I want to use the $1,000 donation to establish a dog park at Patriot Place. We know veterans and the benefits, and our furry companions are members of our family. And so that is what we were talking about. Hopefully we'll have Pooch Park at Patriot Place in the next 6 months. But thank you to all of my friends for coming out tonight. I so appreciate your friendship and everything you have done to help me over the last several decades. It's a privilege and an honor to have worked with so many citizens of Columbia and all of you to continue to keep our city the best place to live, work, raise a family, in a word I'm not sure I know, retire. To the council, thank you for your dedicated service, and it was the second ward. I was elected to first, and to Mayor McDavid, a special thank you for your past 6 years. Thank you. And good luck to you.
Thank you, Marianne, for your legacy of service to Columbia. Those who have contacted the city manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak at the beginning of the meeting on any topic not on the agenda. Only two people can speak on the same topic. Tonight we have two requests. I will yield 5 minutes to Peggy Placier.
Thank you. I am Peggy Placier, and I represent the local organization Race Matters Friends. And this spring, as you know, we have been asking you to hear our public comment to keep your attention on the police department's December 2015 report organized around the pillars or values and recommendations of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Tonight I will speak to the first half of Pillar 4, Community Policing and Crime Reduction. Effective crime prevention is based on community trust, communication, and accountability. Pillar 4 begins with these values, but then argues that funding for additional patrol staffing is the, quote, most significant obstacle to acting on them. We recognize practical limitations of resources, staffing, and time, but any public servant's duty is to do the right thing even when it is very hard. Perhaps voter support for funding is also based on community trust, communication, and accountability. We urge council to ask, how does CPD share power with community members, and is CPD accountable to the community? Recommendation 4.1 states that law enforcement agencies should consider adopting preferences for least harm resolutions, such as diversion programs or warnings and citations. The report cites formation of the Community Outreach Unit, or COU, whose goals are consistent with community policing. Given the target areas for the COU's activities at the time, community seemed to mean the Black and low-income residents of the First Ward. Often public officials avoid mentioning race, which allows them to avoid thinking about how race frames the problem. The report says that the COU appears to be having a positive impact, although the costs are significant. We urge you to ask how thoroughly officers are prepared to develop relationships with Black residents and to demand an accounting of the costs and benefits of the COU. Another sign of progress cited is the 2015 agreement between CPD, the Sheriff's Department, the School District, and the Juvenile Division to allow schools discretion to handle incidents before referring students to the Juvenile Division. Even if a student is referred, the Juvenile Office has alternatives to avoid adjudication. CPD has also implemented least harm resolutions for adults in cases of marijuana possession, traffic violations, and homelessness. We urge you to evaluate whether least harm practices are applied equally regardless of the racial identity of the student or adult. Recommendation 4.2 is that community policing should be infused throughout the culture and organizational structure, including evaluating officers on their abilities to engage the community. The report argues that this is a, quote, noble concept, but difficult with current staff numbers and volume of calls. CPD hired consultants to see how time might be found in the schedule to implement community policing. Based on the findings, a new patrol schedule was slated for February. We urge the council to ask, was the new schedule implemented? Did the data show that time savings result in community benefits? And will all officers be evaluated based on community engagement? Recommendation 4.3 states that law enforcement agencies should engage in multidisciplinary community team approaches for planning, implementing, and responding to crisis situations. CPD utilizes a national system to plan for threats such as civil unrest, an oblique reference to racial conflict in Ferguson. At the time of the report, 35% of officers had completed crisis intervention team training. Thus, a substantial number were prepared for a worst-case scenario, but what about the everyday community interactions that take up much of an officer's time? To me, that is the lesson of Ferguson. How do we prevent civil unrest? Our aim is to respectfully urge you to take this CPD report seriously as a policy document. Council should evaluate CPD's efforts and performance role in ensuring public accountability through open reporting of data and involving community members in decisions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I will yield 5 minutes to Arnie Fagan.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about an interesting topic, leadership, management, and customer service failures at the solid waste utility. Sounds really heavy, but I think I can hopefully make it simple. There's an alley connecting 8th and 9th Street. I'm sure you've all walk down it between Broadway and Cherry Street, just south of Broadway. A problem has arisen in that the trash trucks are waking the residents of the buildings there. They come between 5:30 and 6:30 in the morning. This noise lasts about 10 minutes. It's a backing up of the truck and then mechanically emptying the five metal dumpsters, which includes smashing them against the truck, metal on metal, for about 10 minutes between 5:30 and 6:30 in the morning. The reason I know this is, in addition to complaints I've had from tenants and neighbors, also my wife and I live about 200 feet away, and due to allergies, I never open my window, as well as the cold weather. There are many nice apartments on the block. I've just lost a professional tenant, a physician, who lived in one of the apartments, and one of the things that he mentioned to me was noise. And I said, well, what noise are you talking about? He specifically mentioned these trash trucks. If this is the type of residence that I hear we want to have downtown amongst other people, professionals, then this is a real issue. Though I've traveled a lot with my wife, we've personally been woken up at least 45 times since December 14, 2016. The reason I know that date in particular, other than that I've logged it, is that there was a block meeting that day with Solid Waste Utility Manager Cynthia Mitchell. At that meeting, it was not just me. There was the director of the CID and a member of the CID, and many of the neighbors were there, businesses and such. And she was informed about the problem at this time, that it was, in fact, in addition to other things, a violation of the City of Columbia noise ordinance. During that time, in the last few months, she has done absolutely nothing about it. In February of this year, after months of inaction, there was a peace disturbance complaint filed with the Columbia Police Department, went through several different things, and was left in the hands of Assistant Chief John Gordon to make contact to try to resolve this situation. So this has been going on for months, and this is why I'm here. I'm hoping that you folks can put a stop to this to the betterment of the city and resolve this situation. Since that day, there have been, since that meeting, more than 24 additional violations, or no, since I talked to the police, at least 24 additional violations. This problem only started after the trash compactor was removed from the city leased private alley in the northeast corner of the parking garage. The city rents a space for a compactor. That was removed, and during the block meeting, this was brought up, and and I want to say Katie Essing of the CID has tried to solve this. The board has tried to solve it. She in particular has done a wonderful job in all contacts. We requested that trash compactor be returned to where it had been set for the last 20 years. And I know I was on the SPD board and when we implemented the solid waste district so that the downtown would have some more control over trash and things. They were placed there originally to decrease frequency of collection, decrease smell and mess, make the alleys more attractive for pedestrians, bicyclists, residents, and customers. So the gateway to the alley from 9th Street, on the one side is Alley A. On the other side, our gateway is now a long line of smelly trash, if you want to go to Broadway Brewery or somewhere, or the parking garage. This has led also to certainly accidents in the alley. I don't know if it's more, but it would make sense, as there's less room for vehicles to squeeze past the dumpsters. It's been less safe because if a car is parked there or something, then the vehicle or the pedestrian is a very small area to get through. And in fact, a truck even backed into my main electrical service, which could have knocked out caused significant problems. Ms. Mitchell has blamed the removal on the fact that the new employees weren't experienced enough to remove the compactor to empty it weekly without smashing the neighboring buildings. But the winch they use actually is kind of goes at about less than a mile per hour. So I think that's, in my opinion, a really bad excuse. What I request is leadership from either City Manager Mathis, the City Council, and or Mr. Johnson, who I understand just took over responsibility for this department, And he has, in the past, always been responsive and competent, so I haven't brought this up to him, but found out he's in church. Does anybody have any questions? I do have a lot of other documentation regarding this issue.
Could I just ask a question?
Yes, sir.
I appreciate your concern and certainly the noise and the smell. I mean, these are issues. Do you have any suggestions as to how we might improve this? I mean,
absolutely. Thank you for asking that, Councilman Scala. All that needs to happen is the trash compactor, which was sold to us 20 years ago as a better method, if that is replaced back in the area where it is, there's a space that's rented, the city rents, if that trash compactor goes back there, instead of every two days, this dumping at 6:30 in the morning, it's done once a week because a larger volume is compacted into there. It is not blocking the alley. It'll be safer for everyone. It'll be cleaner for everyone. And this is what's been there for 20 years.
So the trash compactor eliminates both of those problems by eliminating most of the smell because of the compaction and also the number of times that people have to service it.
Yes, as well as the limited access and the visual nature of walking down the alley. There's not as much spillover. So absolutely replacing that compactor that had been there for 20 years. And this was what we talked about at the meeting. It's what's one of the things so frustrating, because this was back in December, and this was talked about, and everybody, I think, thought it was a great idea and has been working toward it, except for Ms. Mitchell.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Fagan.
Thank you.
Please read PH 12-16 and R 40-16.
Public hearing 12-16 is the consideration of the FY 2016 Community Development Block Grant CDBG and Home Annual Action Plan. Council Bill 40-16 is a resolution approving the FY 2016 Community Development Block Grant CDBG and Home Annual Action Plan, authorizing the city manager to submit the plan to HUD, authorizing the city manager to execute funding agreements and certifications, authorizing the city manager to file a finding of no significant impact and to request the release of funds, authorizing the city manager to respond to public comments on the plan, reserving funding and designating Central Missouri Community Action as a community housing development organization, CHODO.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and good evening. Last meeting, we shared with the council and the citizens our report on community development and home-funded activities in fiscal year 15. That was our annual performance report. Tonight we have for you the annual action report, looking forward now and to how the city intends to use its community development block grant and home funds in the current fiscal year. And with us once again is Randy Cole, who's the housing program supervisor. He's going to take us through the document that you have before you, and this is a public hearing as indicated by the clerk. Thank you.
And the FY 2016 action plan summarizes activities that are funded through CDBG or community development block grant and home for FY 2016. And FY 2016 for the city CDBG and home funding is January to December. So this is how far we're in when HUD finally releases the funds. So we're in year two, the FY 2016 of our 5-year plan, which is for 2015 through 2019. HUD notified us of our final allocation on February 16th, and we are mandated by HUD to return a plan to them within 60 days. So it's due April 15th, and we are accepting public comment through April 5th. We had a 30-day comment period that began back at the beginning of March. So each year, we're planning a year in advance, or typically about a year and a half in advance. So when we came into planning for FY 2016, we estimated $839,000 in CDBG and $369,000 in home. And these are just based on information we've received from the field office, as well as through NARO and other groups. Actuals came in. CDBG was pretty close to what we planned for, slightly lower. Home, we got a significant increase, which was unexpected. If you remember back between August and November, we were actually threatened by having the home program reduced completely. So I appreciate the council's support with the resolution to send our congressional delegation. I know there's a lot of efforts nationwide, and I think that shows. This is just a big picture of how our CDBG and home funds are budgeted for FY 2016. This does fluctuate year to year. You can see the bulk of what we fund with both our CDBG and home funds combined is for housing, so slightly over half, about $836,000. Next would be our economic development category, the neighborhood infrastructure, which will be our five bus shelters that we're funding with 2016 funds. And then community facilities. I anticipate our community facilities to be much bigger in 2017. We just received our letters of intent for 2017 funding, and we received a lot of requests in that category. So I do expect that category to be significantly larger in 2017. That gives you an idea of what 2016 looks like. The 2016 annual action plan also includes 2015 community housing development organization funding. We typically do our community housing development organization, or CHOTO, funding in the fall each year in November. HUD instructed us to put our allocations for CHOTO funding into our 2016 plan. So it includes $55,430 in home CHOTO funds that will go to Central Missouri Community Action, and they're partnering with JobPoint for the labor on this project. It'll be a single-family residential construction home at the address of 3704 South Ridge. It's a home we acquired through donation from Wells Fargo. It was a meth lab. We've since demolished the structure, done all the proper environmental clearances, and it's ready for redevelopment. CMCA is changing the address to 3606 Woodside, so included in the packet of the next council memo is also agreement for those funds for 3606 Woodside Drive. I'll take any questions.
Any questions from council? Seeing none, I'll open up the hearing to the public. Would anyone like to speak? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. Any discussion by council?
I think they continue to do a really good job administering these important federal funds. It's really invaluable for, you know, the agencies involved and low-income individuals, and it's good to see this investment in our central city.
Yeah, and just a comment. I mean, this is the kind of thing that typically, along with the budget, makes your eyes glaze over unless you really dig into it. And I certainly appreciate the digging into it from the staff perspective and understanding what's really important in terms of the underserved in our community, which is a huge issue these days. So I appreciate your efforts on this regard. I think everything is above board and perfectly on top of things, and thank you for doing that, and I'm perfectly happy to support your report.
Please call the roll for R40-16.
Council Bill 40-16, Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Please read PH 13-16.
Public hearing 13-16 is a voluntary annexation of property located on the southwest corner of Brown School Road and Range Line Street, Highway 763.
Staff?
This is a public hearing on annexation of a tract of land that's located at the intersection of State Highway 763, known as Range Line Street, and Brown School Road. Tonight requires no action other than opening a public hearing and taking testimony. There is a council bill being introduced that would annex this 70.6 acres and would also assign four zoning categories to that. So that's a Planning and Zoning Commission case that awaits your consideration at your next meeting. This is property that is contiguous to the city limits on the south side and on the west side. Some of the frontage on Rangeline Street on the east side still remains within county jurisdiction. The city has also not only annexed but seen development to the northwest. That's the large Forest Ridge development, which includes the extension of Providence Road. And on the major roadway plan, Providence Road is planned to extend through property and interconnect Brown School and Smiley. It's not part of this development proposal, but that is a future roadway plan feature. A street called White Tiger, there's also an alignment for that planned to reach this area. So there has been some thought given to transportation planning in and around this tract. There are also utilities available to serve the parcel. The Cow Branch trunk sewer does run through the tract along the Cow Branch, which cuts a more or less a diagonal from the northeast to the southwest. Water is available. There is a major water main available to this property, and Boone Electric is the electric service provider. This is in the urban service area. So as indicated, there are neighborhoods both northwest and south of the subject tract. So it does seem to be an area that would be appropriate for city annexation. Try to answer any of your questions.
Council?
Yeah, just this is certainly of interest to both second and third wards. It's in that area. And I take it that this is just to set the process in motion so that the Planning and Zoning Commission can render their recommendation.
They've heard the zoning request, and that does come to you with their unanimous recommendation of approval. There's also a preliminary subdivision plat.
But have they teased out all of the issues with respect to?
We have a development agreement that's forthcoming.
In terms of the various designations of the multi-zoning kind of issues that we're talking about here. So it's kind of a mixed-use thing. There are several zoning designations that are involved here.
Yes.
And that is the recommendation that's forthcoming.
That's right.
Thank you.
Any other questions by council? I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak?
Good evening. My name is Matthew Crudy. I'm with Engineering Surveys and Services, offices at 1113 Fay Street. I'm the civil engineer on the project and, again, representing the owner this evening. Again, it's simply an annexation request this evening. First reading tonight is a development agreement and as well as preliminary plat and rezoning. So there's no public hearing on that this evening. I think Mr. Teddy's explained it fairly well. There's 70.6 acres to be annexed, sitting at the corner of Brown School and Range Line. It is fully serviced by utilities within the urban service area, and it will be zoned with a multiple use zoning districts. And the intent is to provide some transitional zoning as you work from Range Line back towards the west, from more intense to a less intense development. At this point, just to be clear, we do have an existing use on the property that will remain for the foreseeable future. And it does have some minimal setback issues and some gravel lots, signage, and some other nonconforming uses that will remain until it's redeveloped, of course. Again, as I mentioned, there is a development agreement in here. Again, that's not a public hearing for that tonight, but I wanted to touch on a few items with that tonight just so we're clear on what we're looking at.
Do you have slides?
Again, here's the preliminary plat. As it sits today and how it's been submitted to you, Range Line sits on the right-hand side of your screen. Top road there is Brown School Road. Bisecting the site from north to south would be White Tiger Lane. On the southern boundary, north of what is Karen Rose property, is the extension of Boone Industrial Drive. There is a development agreement with this, which defines the Boone Industrial Extension, White Tiger, the utilities that serve the lot, the Brown School road utility relocations are part of this, what's currently in the right-of-way or will be in the right-of-way when that's dedicated, and the trail easement that'll run along the Cow Branch. These are much like what you see on a typical performance contract It's also defines timing, just tied really to the final platting and development of each lot. Again, much like the final, like a performance contract, and generally following the lot frontage. There's a couple atypical situations there. We've worked exclusively with staff, just to give you a little history on this development. The plan, again, a nice transitional zoning. Initially, we had looked at wanting to initially develop what's lots 2 and 3 further to the west on the property. This became a desire for staff to kind of a less intensive use, which moved us more to what's now lot 7. So again, our intent now is to develop lot 7 first. Since staff didn't want any flag lots out the range line, we needed to find some street frontage. So, and we don't have really a need for a lot of these other roadway frontages. So what we've got is kind of an existing situation that creates some awkwardness in here. So what we'd have is White Tiger would be delayed for now for construction, but required as lots 3, 4, and 6 develop. And then there's the extension of Boone Industrial, that would be partially delayed under our request. Now, staff is asking for that to be fully constructed. So what I wanted to highlight is why we are asking for a delay on this. First, if you look at the red line that you can see on there, it's not terribly bold, so I'm going to zoom in a little bit here. The red line in there shows where the current center line of the roadway is planned by MoDOT standards and where they position it. The orange is the MoDOT right-of-way, and the green is a cross-access easement dedicated for use of my client's property from Karen Rowe, and Karen Rowe owns that property. As you can see, we're fixed on that road location. So to be able to extend that road now creates a kind of an awkward situation where the city would have right-of-way that they can't access, they have to maintain, and creating a possible haven for crime that's not accessible as well as you move towards the west. So our proposal was to first put in, you'll see it in your pack, is to put in a cul-de-sac about 600 foot off of Range Line Road to about where the end of that green is. That would have to be a private cul-de-sac for now, built to city standards, and would, well, really just be a private driveway now until that right-of-way can be acquired. So our client is working diligently to negotiate the acquisition of that right-of-way with Karen Rowe, but there's always a potential this is not going to come through and not work. So I wanted to highlight again the last thing is that there are options here, and this may be a surprise to staff, but we've been looking at what happens if this doesn't pull through. I just wanted to show the red of how we could realign the road further north to service the property without having to worry about the acquisition of right-of-way, except for a small piece up near the intersection with Range Line Road. So again, in summary, it's just kind of an awkward situation due to the existing conditions and the transportation needs in the lot right now. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. And
I just have a question. I'm a little puzzled, but I'm not criticizing. I think your offer to suggest an alternative is fine. I don't have a problem with that. But I think you said, you suggested that there was an issue even with in terms of crime prevention because of the way things are set up and so on. That's not my understanding of how it works around here. I mean, yeah. People respond to issues within the city and so on and so forth, or even within the county in terms of the agreements that we have in terms of crime, regardless of what's on the ground here.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting this isn't a better alternative. I don't know that. We're not there yet. This is all about even in terms of dealing with the annexation agreement, the sole agreement in general, and then we can work out the details. But can you care to comment on that?
Yeah, and then again, that's why I want to present tonight, just to kind of give our a little explanation of what our concerns were with where we're at. So we came to an agreement with all but one item with staff, and we just couldn't come to terms on this one. And, you know, I'm very complimentary of staff how they worked. I want to be clear on that as well. But my concern at crime is when you have a long road that's not being used and not seeing frequent traffic and not having people come by, it becomes an easy place just to pull off and, you know, do what's really not legal activities. I can think of other instances. One up north of north and west of Columbia Mall, there's a few roads and some cul-de-sacs back in there that, you know, are there's always some weird things going on back in there. And again, there's just no development, nothing drawing traffic in there on a frequent basis. So it becomes a noted area that can be, it can really be hidden back there.
So you're really moving this a little bit further north so there's more frequent use of this property and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the idea is to, you know, with a 600-foot extension is to, really the request now is a 600-foot extension, is that it becomes a shorter run, it's getting some use and getting some frequency, and the development that's on lot 7, you know, would be utilizing that that lot as well as what's on lot 5. As you extend it further, it's just not going to get used. And really the extension of this idea here is to say, you know, if we can't get the right-of-way, there's, again, some oddity here. If we can't get the right-of-way, what do you do with the road, and how are you going to build it? Well, there's an option available still to move it. I think we still look at that idea of having a shorter section for now, and it's still going to have to be a private road until that right-of-way can be acquired. And it's an awkward situation, because how would you acquire it if you've got a property owner that isn't willing to give up the land and isn't willing to sell it at a reasonable market rate price? Well, you end up in a condemnation situation. Well, as a private property owner, they don't have the rights to do that. And for the city to then step in that situation is also a little odd when there's a, you know, private property owner involved as well. So that becomes the kind of the conundrum we're in, as we're in this fixed position with this roadway based on how everything's developed for range
line. I get that. I appreciate your explanation. Thank you.
So, okay.
And I don't really have a question per se, but I would like to voice my concern with private roads. I've got a problem in the Fifth Ward right now with a private drive that 20 years ago sounded like a good idea, but today has created a problem because things have developed around it, traffic has increased, and what was once a, I'll use air quotes, as a private drive has now turned into a major city street. And so I will be looking for another option other than a private drive when this issue comes back. So I see it's on the introduction, correct, next week for the next meeting? Notation on our council tonight that... yes, CB 7916 under intro and first read. So that's where I think the details will be discussed. So I'll just put that out there so you can work on that in the next couple weeks.
Yes, thank you for a little heads up.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I'll close the public hearing. Any discussion by council? Again, this does not require action tonight. Let's move to old business. Please read B6316.
Council Bill 6316 is an ordinance authorizing a contract for the sale of real estate with Vineyards Columbia LLC for the acquisition of property located southwest of the intersection of Route WW and Rolling Hills Road to be used for park purposes, directing the city clerk to have the contract recorded and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff.
Thank you, Mayor. Our department's requesting council approve to acquire two tracts of land in the Vineyard subdivision. The first is a donation of 18 acres that was part of a previous development agreement. And the second is a purchase of 25 acres for $33,728, or about $1,300 per acre. These are funded by the 2010 park sales tax. This is part of our master plan, where it shows a lack of a neighborhood park in this area. We've been working on this since the early 2000s with when Billy Sapp was developing the property, and that's where the development agreement came part of this donation tract. We are planning on using the donation as part of the natural area. The South Fork of the Grindstand Trail will run through the south corner of this tract. And then we will have a stub street that comes into this park. We'll build a small parking lot with a perimeter trail, and down the road we'll be able to look at possible neighborhood park amenities around the 15-acre lake. We do want to have acquisition of a lot down the road as this development occurs around the property, so we can have access from all sides. Right now we can have good access from everywhere, but really from this east corner and from the north. And we're working with the developer on getting that access down the road. If council concurs that the acquisition is appropriate, staff requests approval of the ordinance authorizing city manager to sign the real estate agreement. We will still have a balance of $940,000 in the parkland acquisition account following this acquisition. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions, council? I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak? Seeing none, any discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 6316, Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala? Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Snauzer?
Yes.
Please read B64-16.
Council Bill 6416 is an ordinance approving the final plat of the Vineyards Plat Number 5, a major subdivision, accepting the dedication of rights of way and easements, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff?
Well, once again, we have a plat that is for park purposes. You just heard Mr. Griggs reporting on park acquisition from the Vineyards tract, and this simply creates the unit of real estate to allow that to happen. The total parcel, 42.8 acres, it's one undivided tract. Action requested is simply approval of it, and it is adjacent to El Chaparral. Currently, what you're seeing at the top of the image is actually the west side of the property, and then future phases of the vineyards will grow around it. It's also in the vicinity of Concord Estates, which is a small county jurisdiction subdivision. Try to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from council?
Tim, the future north grindstone trail south, thank you, is going to pass very close to this property, right? Going to be the same side of the creek as this park or the other side, or do we not know yet?
It'll be on that same side. We're going to come right here. We got this track from the sewer lagoon, the county property many years ago. So we'll come on this side, come through here, and this where we'll cross on this side and continue. And if you look at the aerial, you'll kind of see it's already been kind of mowed out through that area. It'll be a great access, so it's just filling in the pieces as we become available.
Right, it'll be connected right in.
Yes.
And what's the anticipated construction timeline for the trail?
It's not funded currently right now. You know, it would have to be in the next round of ballot issue projects.
Thanks.
And just to remind, this is, again, what the people of the community have spoken about when they sent in their survey, for the park survey, and then subsequently approved the park sales tax extension. And so this is keeping in the spirit of what the community has asked for, correct?
Correct. These are dedicated source of funding.
Thank you.
Any other questions from council?
And they cannot be used for public safety, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that.
Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 6416, Ms. Peters? Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Snauzer?
Yes.
The next three bills were requested to be pulled from consent by Mr. Bill Weitkemper. Please read Bill 75-16.
Council Bill 7516 is an ordinance amending Chapter 12A of the City Code as it relates to billing practices for the stormwater utility and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff?
This is an item that the utility staff is actually pretty excited about. We're in the process of implementing new software for the utility billing system. This new billing system will allow us to better communicate with our customers, and a copy of this new proposed bill format is included in B77 in the documentation. As part of this process, staff has been reviewing ordinances that impact utility billing and is recommending a number of changes that should be made prior to the implementation of the new billing system. These changes are shown in the ordinances that go 75, 76, and 77. These changes or additions reflect taking current practices and policies and representing them in the form of a city ordinance. These do not change the way revenue is generated for the utility and should not have any customer financial impact, with one exception. We in B77, there is a billing oversight that was corrected on 12 water customers at the airport. Currently, the new billing system is anticipated to go live on May 2nd of this year. As you can see, there are a number of changes, and we could walk through them all one at a time, but maybe this would be a good time to just kind of see what questions you may have and what any specific questions you have about any or all of these ordinance revisions. I know the first one is B75, which is stormwater. So if you have any questions about stormwater.
Questions?
So, Tad, you say that none of the changes in these three bills affect the amount people pay or the policies on billing and revenue?
That's correct. That was certainly the intent, was just to make it fit the billing system. We're not impacting revenue. We're not impacting how a customer charges. Like I said, with the one exception, when we were going through these, we found 12 customers in the airport that had been overlooked in a previous revision, so we included those in there. But that's as far as we know.
So just give a high-level explanation of what these bills do if they don't change the actual...
Well, what they do, a good example are the water rates. We have right now 149 irrigation and water rates that we have to change, and that's one of the reasons that we overlooked the airport. The new system uses a calculation rather than a specific number, and so it dramatically reduces the number we have to have, and it just references the primary ordinance, and so that's an example.
So it just really simplifies the code and relates all of these different categories and situations to each other in a way that they should be.
Right.
Yes, and it fits the billing system that we're going to. So some of the changes we had to make it reflect the billing system that we're going to. So they're coordinated and they line up with each other.
My understanding of this, your explanation, is this kind of fills in the gaps of some of the exceptions that were left out when we changed to this new system. Is that?
Yes. In addition, sometimes there's like some, and it says in the notes of the memo, some of these things, like there are some department policies that we operate that way. It's just not in the ordinance. So we took this opportunity, rather than coding our utility billing with a department policy, we put it in the ordinances, so the billing and the ordinances.
But this doesn't affect this doesn't affect policy. Neither does it affect rates, right? This is right. Just a way to capture those exceptions that were left out because we're
yes
because there are some changes being
yes.
made.
Yes,
good on the recycling, for instance, that was not in the code of ordinances, but when the local recycling center went out of business there, they sold a lot of the materials to the city and turned over customers, basically. So we had a policy that we were operating on, but it wasn't codified. So this is doing that, just so it is in the ordinances.
Yeah, thank you.
Would anyone from the public want to comment about B-75? Any discussion about B-75? Please call the roll on B-75.
Council Bill 7516, Ms. Peters?
No.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Please read 76 and 77.
Council Bill 7616 is an ordinance amending Chapter 22 of the City Code as it relates to commercial and multifamily housing, refuse, and recycling services and fees, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Council Bill 7716 is an ordinance amending Chapter 27 of the City Code as it relates to water and electric fees, billing, and rates, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
So this is essentially the same thing, except this covers B-76 covers the solid waste and the commercial multifamily piece, and B-77 covers Section 27, water and electric. I would like to point out that the water and electric piece was discussed and presented to the Water and Light Advisory Board, and they did endorse these, what they called, procedural changes to the ordinances.
Any questions from council?
I actually had requested that this be pulled as well, because I just had a couple questions. Did we used to not charge for recycling for commercial customers, or was it a substantially reduced rate?
The policy had been to do a reduced rate to them, and this just puts it in the ordinance.
So is this at the reduced rate?
Yes, okay. It is.
It is? Okay, because I just wanted to bring this up just to pretty much make a comment, because I know we can't deal with trash at the moment, but as we move forward, I would really like to see a way to incentivize commercial customers to recycle, and charging for this service, unlike we charge for residential customers, seems to be the way to go. And so I'm just putting it out
there. One of the reasons that we have to charge commercial, and we can do a reduced rate, but there is significant cost involved that someone has to pay for. Commercial customers have the option of choosing other suppliers, or I guess, except in certain situations. While we want to make it attractive, if they don't pay something for recycling, someone else has to. So it's a matter of where do you put those costs. But we'll certainly look at that issue.
Right. No, I just understand. I just, you know places, and I see firsthand that they refuse to recycle because they refuse to pay the recycling fee. And so I see dumpsters full of cardboard boxes and, you know, food cans and things that are just filling our landfills. And so that's the only comment I wanted to make. I certainly support moving forward today.
So are you telling me that I mean, we're providing this reduced rate because it's an incentive to help with our recyclable stream?
Yes.
That's the whole point of this, right? I mean, that's the reduced.
It's lower than the trash rate they would pay.
So it's all in the interest of increasing our recyclable stream.
Yes.
Is it working?
I would have to go back and find out. We are part of the process of moving to this new software is to ensure that everybody is paying what they're supposed to be paying, and we're going through a process of checking everything. And but we do have a waste minimization person that is working with commercial customers to try to get them to understand that they have this option. But at some point in the future, we could bring back to you kind of where we think that is.
Any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak?
Mary Hussman, 210 Ridgeway. I just want clarification of the multifamily housing. What are the multifamily? What is that? Is that a duplex within the neighborhood, or is it the large apartments?
It's
or
over
what?
four units.
It's what?
Over four units.
Over four units. Now, over four units in a neighborhood, are you saying that the fees would increase then, or what?
Which one are you speaking about?
I'm just wondering if this code is going to change for a family that's four units in a residential area with a fees change.
No,
I guess
fees,
that's my question.
No fees are being changed.
No fees are being changed.
No.
Okay, good. Because, you know, we want to keep everything in the residential area as is, as you know. Thank you.
Anyone else? Any discussion by council?
I would just add that residential does pay for recycling. It's just built into the solid waste rate, which is not going to change, Mary.
Just a comment.
Congratulations. You know,
I would look forward to that evaluation as to how this is working out, because, I mean, I'm prepared to endorse this. I think that incentive is probably in the right place, but I want to make sure that it's working.
Okay.
Please call the roll on B76-16.
Council Bill 7616, Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Call the roll on B77-16.
Council Bill 7716, Ms. Peters?
Yes.
McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 6216, 6516, 6616, 6716, 6816, 6916, 7016, 7116, 7216, 7216, 7316, 7416, and 7816, and resolutions 3616, 3716, and 3816.
Please call the roll.
Bill 6216, 6516, 6616, 6716, 6816, 6916, 7016, 7116, 7216, 7316, 7416, 7416, 7816, and resolutions 3616, 3716, and 3816. Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Please read R34-16.
Council Bill 3416 is a resolution declaring the necessity for construction of a single lane, roundabout, splitter islands, and 5-foot sidewalks, and the installation of additional street lighting at the intersection of Fairview Road and Chapel Hill Road, stating the nature of and the estimate of the cost of the improvement, providing for payment for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law, and setting a public hearing.
Staff, please.
Thank you. Staff is proposing to set a public hearing for May 2nd, 2016 to construct a 110-foot inscribed circular diameter urban single lane roundabout at the intersection of Fairview Road and Chapel Hill. The design includes splitter islands and a 5-foot sidewalk placed 4 feet off the back of the curb on all four sides and additional street lighting. The proposed roundabout will accommodate commercial vehicles and school buses. Extensive street right-of-way already exists on the northwest corner of the intersection. However, additional permanent street and utility easements and temporary construction easements may be necessary. The CIP budget for the project is $600,000 and will be funded from the 2015 quarter cent improvement sales tax, and the project is expected to be built next summer, 2017. An IP meeting was held on January 28, 2016, and the public hearing is the next step in the public improvement process. Be happy to answer any questions.
What were the comments that you heard at the interested parties meeting?
We had about, I got a summary, there were about 17 positives. There were about 22 that were opposed to a roundabout and one that was indecisive.
Did they give any reasons why?
Just a general feel that it wasn't necessary for that intersection. What staff's proposing is to set this in front of capital projects that are on the horizon for us. Nifong Boulevard is in a 2020 construction to rebuild that. We've got two intersections on Nifong at Sinclair and Old Mill Creek. They're 2018 construction. So when we close Scott Boulevard with the bridge closure and phase two, Chapel Hill experienced a tremendous amount of traffic diverted. And so we anticipate these future projects causing that same situation. So the improvement at this intersection should help relieve that. We had a lot of concern from people that had to use the road, and that intersection was problematic. And so we're trying to get ahead of that. But this was a ballot project that was approved at the August vote. So either we can do the project beforehand, which staff is recommending, or this is something that could be pushed out later. Just depends on council's wish.
Well, I'm interested to hear the numbers you gave for and against at the IP meeting, because I was at that IP meeting, and I didn't hear anybody have a positive comment about it.
I think a lot of people were confused that we were putting the same one that's down the street on Rollins, and so we made it
there's
very
no question
clear
that there's a lot of confusion and a lot of antipathy towards the one at Rollins and Fairview.
Right.
I've been involved in email conversations with just about every resident of the subdivision immediately south of this location, and they are almost entirely unified against this. And I would like some information before we go to a public hearing, because I think they'll come out in strong opposition, and we need to have a more considered process to engage that neighborhood. And I'd asked Richard for a couple of things. One was he did a speed study, I understand, at Rollins and Fairview, that roundabout, and he was going to send me the results of that.
Or the Rollins?
The Rollins and Fairview one, yeah, because I want to be able to show the neighbors what is happening at Rollins and Fairview and how the design of the one at Chapel Hill and Fairview is different.
Okay. We had those displays at the IP and
the speed study at Rollins and Fairview?
No, the sides of the roundabouts. And I think that once people started understanding that difference, they had a lot of other additional comments, but the ones I mentioned that weren't opposed just wanted to make sure some other features were included. But we'll work on getting that speed study to you then.
And then the second thing was actual counts of the backup of traffic at Chapel Hill and Fairview, that is the need to build the roundabout to improve the traffic flow at that location. It's my understanding, I know when Scott Boulevard was closed, the traffic did back down the hill to the County House Branch bridge, but when I've been out and observed it, I've never seen, even at the busiest time, more than about 10 or 15 cars waiting, and it takes a car just a couple of minutes from joining the back of that line to getting there. But I'd like some real, and I asked Richard to do this, to get some actual reliable data on those traffic backups at that intersection.
Traffic backups. The number of cars at any particular time?
I guess. I mean, how do you quantify? I mean, you're the engineer. How do you quantify congestion at an intersection in order to decide whether it warrants spending $600,000 or not to improve flow?
Yeah, there'd be a level of service type analysis.
Okay.
Just a question. I'm not suggesting the data. The data is the data, and you do the level of service analysis and so on, and do the numbers. But we have so many needs in this town for when it comes to traffic issues and roundabouts and so on and so forth. And this reminds me a little bit about the issue that when we talked about trails and so on, we tended to avoid the ones that were the most controversial, that there was the most equivocation on, if you will. And we tended to focus on those ones that had a lot more support without any equivocation. I think that might be the way that we want to approach this. I mean, I'm not questioning the data and the need for this kind of thing, but we have so many needs and so many unmet needs that we may want to move on, given if this is in fact a 17 to 23 or whatever the numbers were, decision by the folks that are involved in this. To move on to one that's overwhelming, that's 75% or 80%. I'm just saying, from a policy perspective, we have less money than we have needs, and we have to focus on those areas that most of the folks really want to pursue this.
Yeah, correct, and this is just to set that public hearing to have that dialogue, and that's where we're shooting for in May, is to have the open public hearing.
Would you be opposed to delaying this public hearing to allow a little more informal communication with the neighbors? I'm in a conversation with them right now.
Sure, we can accommodate that. If you can give us a date, we'll bring it back.
Could we maybe put it back 2 months after the May the 2nd, so make it the first council meeting in July?
That wouldn't be a problem with staff.
That's going to be July 5th, 4th of July holiday, right after that, just pointing that out.
I mean, are we having a meeting that night?
July 5th.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a Tuesday.
Let me clarify. Do you want to set the date of hearing for that meeting, or you want to table this action of setting a date until?
No.
I don't mind. It kind of makes it's pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
Well, you have to amend the motion. One amends the motion, the other tables this.
Well, why can't we just set the date a month ahead before? I mean, if we're going to be talking about dates here just for the hearing, we could just delay that for a month or so to allow some communication here, and then we can set the hearing for the
table it for a month. We'll talk to the neighborhood, and then we can set the hearing.
That'd be great. I think that's
is that your motion, Mr. Thomas?
Well, I'm not quite sure what it is.
Motion to table for a month.
Table for a month to set table
the resolution to set the public
set
hearing.
Yes.
For a month. So everything moves back a month.
Exactly. Yes.
So the public hearing will be the first meeting in June.
Yeah,
I'm not necessarily.
You just come back and
it doesn't have to be in June. Let's do that. Let's table this for a month. Yeah, that's my motion.
I'll second that.
Public hearing.
So we're not setting the public hearing yet.
No.
Just because as we move forward on this, I just think it's just bad policy when you have things that are for high interest
to one more meeting after that.
Put anything near a holiday weekend.
Right, and I would second that suggestion.
We have a motion to table for 1 month, the motion to set the hearing. Any discussion on the motion to table? All in favor of the motion to table, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
We should probably have a public hearing, shouldn't we?
Well, the public hearing is not on whether we do the roundabout.
Okay.
The public hearing is only on whether we have a public hearing.
That's right.
But I,
all right.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has anything to say, but I think
right.
from a.
Yeah, this is, we're not accepting or rejecting the roundabout.
Tabling an issue doesn't necessarily. I mean, we often extend that courtesy to folks that
right.
are here to talk about that, but it's not.
Did we vote? All in favor of the motion to table?
We did.
All right,
we did. It was unanimous.
In which case, we'll go to R35.
Council Bill 3516 is a resolution setting a public hearing on the voluntary annexation of property located at the western terminus of Smith Drive, approximately 3,000 feet west of Scott Boulevard.
Staff?
This is a resolution that sets the public hearing on an annexation, and the date is April 18, 2 weeks from now, and that's our standard practice. This is a case that has been through the Planning and Zoning Commission, and our plan as of this moment is to introduce reports on the zoning, permanent zoning of the tract, subdivision, and plan approval, and by introducing that on April 18, that item would come up on old business on your May 2nd agenda as it stands right now. So, try to answer any questions you might have.
So the way this is set up, there would be a public hearing but no vote on the 18th of April, and then the vote on May the 2nd.
That's correct. Similar to the annexation hearing we had on the Christensen LLC property on Rangeline Street, we would just conduct the hearing and then 2 weeks later take up the actual annexation ordinance along with the zoning and subdivision.
Any questions from council?
I just have interest in, I realize we're not going to vote at the public hearing at the next meeting, but I have a lot of questions. And so the neighbors asked if I could have that moved to a date because I'm not going to be at that April 18th meeting. So I think Mr. Thomas said, I was interested in moving it back one meeting, but I think he wants to move it back further. So,
yeah. Of course, it's not certain that I'm going to be on the council on April the 18th, but if I am, either way, I'm not going to be at this meeting. I think that there is an evolving negotiation between several impacted neighborhoods and the developer, and I think we need to leave time for that to take place. It is getting started right now, and I've been in communication with the developer. They're happy to delay the public hearing on the annexation to May 16th, and I would like to make that proposal. Or we could do the same things we did on the last thing, and which is to table the decision.
I'd rather table the whole thing.
Table this resolution for a month like we did with the other one. And bring this back on May 2nd.
I'd second that.
Yeah, and that seems reasonable to me. I mean, I'll defer to to the ward and so on. Regardless, I'm hoping you're back, but nonetheless, I think that's a reasonable approach to take for an issue like this is controversial.
Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion?
Pardon me. Wait. Hang on just a second.
Yeah, March 24 is when we certified their annexation.
Staff is discussing there are time frames within the city code that require that we act on certain petitions within a particular point in time. So if you can hang on just a second, we are double checking that time frame. So if, Tim, can you speak to that?
Yeah, we have a annexation petition that was certified on March 24, and the state statute, I believe, says we act on that within 60 days.
60 days.
Yeah. So 60 days from March 24.
Yeah, so that does take us just beyond the second meeting in May. Otherwise, we'll be requesting a new petition of the applicant. That has happened before. It hasn't happened in a long while, but I know that happened in one of our annexation cases where there were some issues. It required some tabling. But
at the moment, the motion on the
council
table,
aware of that.
The motion on the table is to delay this resolution by a month.
And so you wouldn't actually set the hearing until the May 2nd for the 16th.
But we could then set it for the 16th, and it would still be within the 60
days. And then
that
would put the zoning items into June.
Right, and the 60 days doesn't apply to the zoning items, only to the annexation?
Well, the annexation ordinance needs to be approved within 60 days.
That's legitimate if we did it that way, right?
I see.
The annexation, you need to hear the ordinance before.
Do we need to have made a decision on it by the 24th? So we would need to vote on it on the 16th, so we would need to have a public hearing on the 2nd.
So we could table this to the April 16th.
You can hold your public hearing the same.
I don't think that's enough time.
You can hold your public hearing the same night that you do the second read.
You know, we can table it again.
If that's
necessary, but it may be enough time. I mean, I don't know.
I think what you're saying, to avoid resubmitting the annexation request, the public hearing has to be held on May the 2nd with the vote on May 16th. I don't support that. I don't think that's enough time.
But if we don't, is it what happens if we don't have the hearing?
They have to resubmit. How much is that? A lot of work for somebody.
And do they have to resubmit, or does it automatically become annexed?
No, it wouldn't automatically become annexed. I would imagine it'd be automatically denied. It's not something I looked up tonight before we came, but it does not automatically annex.
But how much is it a lot of trouble to reapply?
Well, I can just say, it's really a question for the applicants, not a trouble for staff, but sometimes applicants have to track down the person who's the record owner of the property. I don't know if there's anyone living on the property. We show that it's a trustee of a trust that's signed as the owner requesting this annexation.
This is going to be a very controversial annexation and development plan, and I don't think that holding the public hearing on May the 2nd and the vote on May 16th is adequate time for those conversations to happen. So I want to maintain the motion that I already put out.
You know, just in terms of discussion, on the other hand, I mean, we always have the option to delay this further, depending upon whether or not we make any progress on these discussions. I'm not suggesting that it's enough time. I'm just saying.
Let me ask another question. If we just table this for one meeting, get those questions answered that we have about what happens if we still meet the deadlines if we have to go, I think. Is that?
Yeah, because you'd be hearing it on the 2nd, the annexation you'd hear on the 2nd, and then the zoning item would come up on the 16th.
Well, I guess
the recommendation would be to table this just for one meeting while we get those questions answered. You're still able to make the same decision.
Table it again if we want to. All right.
Yeah, and you could table the zoning phase of it
better than we're not prepared for tonight.
Do we have a motion on the floor?
All right, so I'll change the motion then just to table this resolution till the next meeting.
And I would second that.
Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. R-3916.
Council Bill 3916 is a resolution amending resolution number 3215A, which established the Community Tree Task Force.
Staff?
You have a very nice report from the Community Tree Task Force. It was appointed last March. They've served out their time as expressed in that resolution. One of their three recommendations to the council is that you extend their time for another year. This would enable them to participate in and see to completion the tree preservation aspects of the development code update, and also participate in and give advice on an urban forest master plan, which is in the request for qualification stages right now. They also have an ongoing program called MIDMO Taproot Series, which is an educational program that seems to have drawn a lot of interest. So we've prepared a resolution that would affect that one-year extension. And if we have someone here from the task force, they may want to.
Real quick question before we have public comment.
Any questions from council?
Yes, I had a couple. I'm looking at this resolution.
Can you, the original resolution, what was the scope of the task force? Because I'm looking at this and it's talking about making recommendations on a study and evaluation of tree care on private property, which concerns me. Review of current tree policies and ordinances, which, you know, there's some room to have some conversations on that for annexations, et cetera. And the development of a process to perform decennial citywide tree inventories, which I don't have any concern about that, but I have some real concern about this evaluation and study of tree care on private properties. Because, so can you please tell me what the original scope was when this tree task force was first commissioned and what their objectives were and why they're requesting this change? I guess maybe the applicant or the individual could maybe answer some of those questions as well.
Yeah, I think it's expressed in the original resolution from, looks like it was adopted in February of 2015. And it's primarily expressed in that section one. So it's given advice and recommendations to private property owners on tree care, developing educational materials, the recommendations to neighborhood and homeowner associations on tree management, reviewing ordinances and policies and within the city, and then recommending methodology for decennial tree inventories. And recommending whether there should be an ongoing tree commission. So the rest of the resolution is the composition of the commission. So those are the activities, and I would think the urban forest management plan and the development code, as well as the taproot series, are all kind of in keeping with that section one.
Okay.
The way I'd see it.
Okay, thank you.
So at the risk of beating this dead horse, I originally introduced this idea about the, and it was based on Darwin Hindman's idea about a tree canopy board a long time ago, and you may remember this. And so I am correct in assuming that what they have asked for is consistent with what the original intent was, and that is to get a citizens group to advise us with respect to tree issues in general, and they've run out of time, and they need extra time to plow this fertile ground.
Yeah, I think it's been productive. There's been 11 meetings. Our city arborist staffs those meetings, provides staff support. So there's been a lot of work accomplished, as you can see in the report, and I think it is within the scope of the.
And ultimately, the city council has the veto power anyway. Whether I mean, with your concerns, I mean that taking into consideration your concerns about private kinds of individual trees and so on private property, I mean that we have that prerogative.
Correct. I'll make up my mind between now and the time we vote. But I don't recall supporting this originally. So,
would anyone from the public like to speak?
Hi, my name's Ann Koenig. I've been up here before with my job, but I'm here. I'm the chair of the task force, the tree task force. And just to address your concerns, I wasn't sure where you were referring to the private property issues with trees, but if it's the recommendation that we were to provide private property owners with just general tree recommendations, our interpretation of that was to do like educational workshops on tree care, how to plant trees, how to prune trees, how to select the right tree in the right place, that sort of thing. So that's how we interpret it, to do educational programs, which we've been doing. And
I'm all for education.
Yes. that's how I interpreted that. That's how we interpreted that section, at least if that's where, if we're looking at the same thing. Do you all have any questions for the task force?
I will just ask one question. I mean, you just talked here for a few moments. Do you see the task force going down the road of, I know many communities across the country have tree boards where people have to have permission to plant trees, cut down trees, prune trees. I mean, I don't want our community to come to the point where we have to go to a board if we have a tree that's dying and needs to come down or becoming a hazard and have to go through a bureaucracy to take care of things that are on our own property. And that's my concern with this.
It's a legitimate concern. And so what we've been doing is reviewing the city's tree ordinances and making recommendations that will then come forth to you all. And we
in those, you know, looking at those recommendations, we've been very, tried to be very respectful and cognizant of private property rights and those sorts of issues. So we haven't had any meetings with any agenda of trying to do anything on private property or influence any private property rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm. And you tell me something more about the educational programs you've initiated and where and mm-hmm. how the word gets out.
Yeah, good question. So for one thing we've done is just enhance the city arborist. The city arborist has a webpage, and so we've put a lot more information on there about how to care for trees and what trees to select and staying away from utility lines with trees and whatnot. And then we've done a series of, thank you for mentioning the Taproot series, general public programs on how to care for trees. We had one on insect disease and issues. We had one on how to tap trees to get maple syrup on your own private property. Try to get tree selection, tree pruning. We've been having those in the evenings at a place where there's at a restaurant where people can, it's free, but if you want to get dinner, have a drink, kind of socialize and have this program to try to get a different sort of crowd. I think we've done four of those so far, and they've been well attended, trying to, like I say, speak to a different crowd than we normally speak to.
I just had a question, and I admittedly, this is an advisory commission like all our commissions and boards are, and the buck stops here eventually. But originally, when this was put forward, and with the inspiration, if you will, of Darwin when he was the mayor, mm-hmm. and he was talking about an urban tree canopy and so on, there was a lot of collaboration with the GIS system that we have tremendous resources in the community in terms of GIS and impermeable surfaces and so on, and trees, and depending on where they take the pictures. Has your group been really involved in talking about some of the coordination with GIS systems in terms of this overall tree canopy idea? Or I'm just curious. I should have followed it a little bit closer then.
No, that's okay. So we came to the council, I'm going to estimate maybe 6 months ago, and asked about just supporting the idea of an urban forest master plan, which would incorporate a lot of GIS partnership and information in it. And so the city is now has a request for qualification to do an urban forest master plan. So that's where you get folks collaborating with maps and canopies and canopy goals and wards and what our current canopy assessment is in each ward and what you might want it to be and how we're going to get there and things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And one other quick question. Just made me think. So the urban forest master plan would essentially then help if there was an outbreak of a disease within certain trees, we would know where the species of trees are most predominant, where mm-hmm. resources could and information could be presented to both property owners and as a community. Correct? Would that be a correct interpretation of
that would be part of an urban forest master plan? Is part of it would be assessing what trees do you have, what species do you have, what condition are they in, and where are they? So if a disease like emerald ash borer comes in, you would know right away where are the ash, where are the largest ash, where are the ash that are most vulnerable to succumbing the, you know, quickest, and what do we need to take care of first. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any discussion by council?
I have a comment. I think the reason that we asked the task force to focus on private property specifically is that the city already has robust tree programs through parks and a number of other departments. So I think city staff were really looking to try to answer Mr. Scala's request by giving the task force work to do, and so they identified that kind of education piece in regards to private property owners as kind of one of the few tree niches that were open. I don't think it was meant to be a step towards a tree board, or it's really to focus on that. That's about the only thing that we weren't already doing.
And just a comment about that, to follow up on that, and I appreciate that, Mike, this whole initiative, an early initiative about the tree board, We have two sources of information. We get information from the staff. That's our professional staff. That's the tree arborist and all the rest of it. Those are the folks that are in the trenches, and they do yeoman's work for us. We also get a different perspective. We get a different perspective from the volunteer organizations that are our tree board, well, not tree boards, but boards and commissions in general, which is kind of a different perspective on this whole thing. And that has to do with community consensus and residents and individuals and so on. And I think the blend of those two sources of information are incredibly valuable into our ability to make decisions based not only on the facts and the professionals who give us all the information, but also what the folks want to see as well. And I think that's the value of some of these boards and commissions, including the tree board, to take some of this information and interpret it in terms of what some of the folks want, maybe even in terms of the comprehensive plan and so on and so forth. So I mean, these are very, very valuable sources of information, and I have no problem at all with extending the lifetime of this task force to accomplish some of their goals.
And I appreciate you coming in and answering some questions and about the concerns, because, you know, I value the trees on my property, and I know the community values the trees within our community. I think that's one of the things that make the city of Columbia such a unique community. I do have the concerns, and I will continue to have those concerns as you see other communities moving in that direction to where we micromanage everything that everyone does. And so I will never support the micromanaging through the bureaucracy of the community having a tree board that would dictate what people can and can't do with the trees on their property. But I will say, I think you've done a considerable amount of good work. The trees in my yard actually have a fungus, and so it's spreading through all of the trees through our entire, I mean, my neighbor has the problem, and I have a problem, and several other neighbors have a problem as well, and it's requiring arborists to come and actually give some kind of antibiotic to the trees. But it will continue to spread throughout all of the trees throughout the neighborhoods unless there is an ability to stop that. So I will continue to support your efforts, especially since it's focused on education and getting information to people. And so thank you. This is one of those instances where I actually have changed my vote, because I think last time I did not support the tree board for some of the concerns that I've said, but I've seen the work that you've done, and I will support the continuation for another year.
Please call the roll.
Councilbill 3916, Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
We'll move to introduction and first reading. Please read the bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bill 7916, 8016, 8116, 8216, 8383, 1684, 1685, 8616, 8716, 8816, 8816, 8916, 9016, 9116, and 9216. First reading.
The first report, 2616, is a report from the Business Loop CID, which we approved in April of 2015. It has a seven member board of directors. One of the members has resigned, and the way the ordinance is set up is that the CID board makes a recommendation, which the council then has to approve. The Business Loop CID has recommended Police Frankie Brown to be appointed to serve the remainder of Dan Rader's term, which ends in April of 2017. I move that we appoint Police Frankie Brown to that term. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Our report 2716 is a report. Staff is asking us whether we should produce an ordinance to vacate east-west alley between 203 East Walnut and 115 North Providence Road. Staff?
This is really just requesting your direction to continue the process. We've been contacted by Central Bank of Boone County about the vacation of not the entire alley, but just the alley that is between their properties to the south and to the north of it, and it'd be the portion that does intersect with Providence Road. It is a paved alley. So we will, with your direction, we'll prepare an appropriate ordinance and bring that before you at a later date.
Can I just ask a question? Why and where does their responsibility for the maintenance of this alley exist? I mean, and how would this change?
Well, it's a public alley now, so the city has maintenance responsibility of it. I don't know without seeing the report of staff what utilities might be within it or under it, but that's what we typically evaluate, is whether there needs to be maintenance of at least a utility corridor. And then, of course, we'll solicit opinions regarding its use as a service alley as well.
And that evaluation will be consistent with this request, essentially.
Correct. Yeah. So we don't have the benefit of the comments of all departments just yet, but we're getting this process started. We started this practice of bringing reports to you after we had vacated an alley and brought the bill forward, when it was really too late for council to have, you know, really raise any questions about it, because I believe in that instance a electric circuit had already been located out of the alley and a building built. So this would just get ahead of issues like that. We don't really foresee any major issue with this one from where we sit right now, but like I say, we'll solicit comments from all the involved departments and report that to you.
I move that staff prepare an ordinance to vacate a portion of the east-west alley located between 203 East Walnut and 115 North Providence Road.
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor say aye. Yes.
I just have a question. It says, to this point in the review process, no utilities were identified as being located within the alley or potentially being impacted. So has your staff looked at that, or you had said you didn't know about it?
Yeah, I think staff, to the extent that there might be city utilities in there, what we'll usually start with is looking at the maps that we have available to us showing where our storm sewer, sanitary sewer, and electric are located.
So really no one's reviewed it?
We've reviewed it preliminarily.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, you can keep going now.
Any other discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Report 2816 is the final report on the mayor's task force on pedestrian safety. Mr. Thomas, do you want to take it?
Yeah, I think I'd like to ask Leanne Johnson to come up and give a brief presentation about the work of the
How much time do you need, Ms. Johnson? Pardon me? Oh, you can have more than that? I'm generous in my last meeting.
Good evening. My name's Leanne Johnson, and I'm a member of the Task Force for Pedestrian Safety. A little bit of my background is I'm a 28-year nurse on the helicopter, and so I've seen trauma firsthand. The last 3 years, I'm trauma manager at the University Hospital, Level 1 Trauma Center. So I've seen a lot of trauma up close and personal, and I would just like to say this is something that I take very seriously, and I appreciate the mayor developing the task force. Getting an opportunity to prevent people from getting hurt is so important, and I thank the council for allowing me to speak. Nationally, there's a rise in pedestrians struck. From 2009 to 2014, there's been a rise of 20%. That's 4,884 people killed. In Columbia, we've also had a significant rise. From 2014 and fall to the early 2015, we had 4 people that were killed, 6 people that were struck by cars and injured. One young lady on our task force was even struck while going to school. We've even more recently had a fatality in early March. one of the citizens was struck by a bus. So I thank Mayor McDavid for appointing the task force. There's 15 of us, and we worked very hard on this project. We all took it very seriously. We met regularly. We reviewed reports, reviewed the data. We analyzed the crashes. We formed subcommittees, the three E's, education, engineering, and enforcement. We agreed on points of consensus. We came up with 16 recommendations. Our priority recommendation is adopt Vision Zero. Vision Zero is a philosophy of transport systems designs and operations that maintains three key principles. Safety is the most important factor in transport planning. Traffic deaths and serious injuries are preventable and therefore unacceptable. Transportation systems should be designed so that user errors are not fatal. This program has been very successful in other cities, and I think it could be very successful in our city. I've lived in Columbia 33 years, and I'm very, very proud of it, and I think we can do better when it comes to pedestrian safety. A few other recommendations. I won't go through them all because I know it's getting late, but one recommendation that came out of the Education Committee, and that was the committee I was co-chair on, was adopt 1% for safety education, and that would be requiring all major expenditures for roadway projects to set aside 1% for safety education. Develop a comprehensive and ongoing safety education and communication campaign. Many, many citizens are confused over new infrastructures, even the flashing yellow arrows. People don't get it. I mean, they don't understand, and we just have terrible things that happen in our city because of this confusion and lack of education. And so I think this is very, very important. Excuse me, am I too close to this? The enforcement campaign, that group came up with some wonderful ideas, and we all supported each other, everything that we discussed. But one of theirs was the prohibit cell phone usage and texting while driving. We feel like an ordinance would send a message that this behavior isn't culturally acceptable, and we could set the bar here in Columbia and really make a point on that. Reduce legal speed limits that are posed. Research shows that high-speed crashes between pedestrian motor vehicles are likely fatal the higher the speed is, as opposed to low-speed crashes. And I know this firsthand. I mean, I get more prepared for that patient when I hear it's going to be a high-speed crash as opposed to low-speed. The engineering department would propose start new programs for road safety audits and assessments so that we can look at those more closely. There are many other recommendations, and you have the reports, and I implore you to look at them and consider these recommendations. In summary, the task force was a process that was very effective, diverse, and every member brought an important perspective to the recommendations. Everyone was engaging, and I appreciate and thank the task force and Councilman Thomas and Ruffin for their support on it. And furthermore, I thank the mayor for setting up this task force, and I ask you to consider the exception of these recommendations. Thank you. Any questions?
I just had one question. I know I followed this a little bit, primarily because my wife is on the Board of Health. And there was some resistance, and I'm not suggesting I have to look into it more. This whole zero program, yes, if you will, there was some resistance to that program based on data and so on and so forth within the context of the Board of Health. Were you part of that conversation, or how did that come out, or do you? Can you comment on any of that?
I'm not familiar with what you're speaking to there, but I do know
there was a presentation for this for the issue that you were talking about. Mm-hmm.
There's many Vision Zero concepts across the country. The Vision Zero I'm speaking to is adopted in New York. It's adopted in Seattle and Denver. There's several cities that have adopted it and have shown a decrease in their data based on the policies of Vision Zero. No death is acceptable with Vision Zero.
Well, I certainly agree with that. Prevention is worth everything in public health, but right. I'm just curious as to whether or not you're involved in that discussion.
Well, I know MoDOT has Vision Zero. There's a lot of different Vision Zeros. Helicopter companies have Vision Zeros across the nation, no more crashes. So the concepts are very strong and very apparent and work. So anything else?
Thank you. I think we'll have a lot of things to talk about. Mr. Thomas, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I'd like to thank Leanne for that presentation. A couple of other task force members are in the room, James Beattie with MoDOT and Katie Essing with the CID. And as Leanne said, it was a diverse and very engaged task force. I think Clyde will join me in thanking the staff that facilitated the process, Mitch Scove from Community Development, and several members of the Public Works Department and the Columbia Police Department, Parks and Recreation. We came out, and there were several guests as well, non-task force members who joined the subcommittees and brought a new perspective as well. So please do take a look at the report. I believe that Mitch is going to arrange for some printed copies to be made available to task force members, and we'll look to start to implement some of those recommendations in a little while.
Let me...
Why, did you want to add something?
Yes, I just wanted to say I also very appreciative for all of the work and the consistent engagement of our committee, and when the mayor asked me to serve on as a co-chair, it was because many of the fatalities had happened in the first ward, and it was not because I knew anything about pedestrian safety. So it has been an incredible learning experience for me, and I want to commend Councilman Thomas for all of his hard work and his vision and his knowledge that guided this entire process to completion. So it's been great.
Let me say a couple things. First of all, I'm delighted with this product and thank the members of the task force for all their work. Certainly I think this is a community that will endorse the concept of Vision Zero. I wish there was a way, and I don't know if it's too late in the process or if there could be an addendum to the report. I wish there was better longitudinal data about accidents. I understand that nationally pedestrian injuries have gone up. We don't know why. There's just simply more pedestrians or more cars. We don't know. I wish we had that benchmark here. I wish we could look back and put it on a graph, because we're going to be doing some things. And I think the future councils are going to want to see if we can bend the curve.
But we have those data. They just didn't make it into the actual report.
Okay. So, I think that would be.
Yeah.
I would look forward to that as a citizen.
Yeah.
I also think it would be very useful if you could find comps on this for comparable cities. I mean, national trends notwithstanding, it would be useful, I think, to most of us to know what Lexington, Kentucky, Ames, the comparable university cities, how they stack up. So we can give ourselves a report card. Our report card will be based on our impact on injuries, and it will be based on how we stack up to other cities. This is going to take a lot of work, and I envision the next council having a work session really to work through this. I have to say that there are some suggestions that the public will oppose. We know that. Red light cameras. We've been down that road. Speed cameras, I'm not sure, are legal in Missouri. I know that. Are they? I know that was a big controversy in St. Louis and St. Anne, that area. But anyway, that's something for
the... Certainly there are guidelines that
you have to... Yeah, you will have to deal with that. I suspect there will be resistance, and that will be the goal and responsibility of the council to change the way the public views those things. I also feel as though a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit is probably going to be very difficult to sell the public on. It's tough to get people to drop to 20 miles an hour in school zones. And I anxiously wait to see how you manage the challenge of dealing with a public who will be resistant to some of these issues. But I think the task force, and I endorse the concept of Vision Zero, and let's just see how well we can do in the years ahead.
Just to comment, this is one of those, well, it's not, it, actually, in lately it's been less rare than it has been before where I agree with you on some of these issues, but this benchmark thing is... but nonetheless, I mean, you know, I certainly, I'm not precluding any of this, and I certainly like the idea of the whole Vision Zero approach and so on. I think there is a lot of data that can suggest that we can improve things, and I wholeheartedly support the idea of public health when it comes to prevention being the certainly not only the least expensive, but the most in terms of preserving the safety of pedestrians. And let me just share an anecdotal moment with you, because 2 years ago I was hit in an intersection by a car. The woman was mortified, actually, that she hit. She hit my wife, and my daughter. My daughter had a bit of a knee and neck injury. I flew across the street. It kind of reminded me of being Superman. But I remember you know how you fly across the street. And I skinned myself a little bit, and to the credit of the city, I mean, the fire truck was there, the ambulance was there, everybody was there. It was a big deal, right? And I had stood up after I got knocked down in the street. My wife stood up. My daughter knocked the rearview mirror off of this car, and she went to the hospital. We spent the night in the hospital while she was getting stitches from someone just kind of turning left. After we had gotten out of a concert, I was in a tuxedo. You never see me in a tuxedo, but I was in a tuxedo, and we spent the night in the hospital because she was getting stitches and so on and so forth from a car turning left on a very dark and rainy night on campus, Connolly and 6th Street. So I get it. I mean, this whole thing and preventable kinds of injuries like that is certainly something we ought to shoot for. But the kind of benchmark idea that you have, I think, would be very compelling to the public in order to pursue this as a strategy moving forward. So I applaud all the efforts of this group, and I applaud your sponsoring this whole idea, because it's something that we absolutely need to do. If it's a preventable accident, we ought to prevent it, frankly. So thank you for that.
Are there any other comments? If not, we'll move to report 29, which is a report from the Environment and Energy Commission. And they are proposing that an ordinance change requiring a minimum score for home energy scores for energy efficiency for rental certificates. And you are representing the Energy and Environment Commission?
I am. My name's Jan Dye. I'm the chair.
Okay. How long can you present it in 5 minutes?
I can. I can probably do it quicker than that. The report is an effort to increase energy efficiency in homes used by students, lower income, and elderly citizens. The commission proposes a provision in Article 5, Section 22-186, having to do with rental certificates. That's a certificate that landlords have to get in order to rent out their homes or their properties. And we outline it in detail in the report that we've submitted to the council. We believe that this change will significantly improve the quality of housing available for the groups mentioned above, and it's a long-term commitment to energy efficiency. One thing that we do agree with the Building and Construction Codes Commission is that we don't believe enough is being done to address the lack of modern energy efficiency in already existing older homes. While newer building codes can address deficiencies in new buildings, they can't do anything to address older homes that were built before energy efficiency was a concern. We believe that energy efficiency is important for all homes, not just owner-occupied homes. And these are not easy conversations to have, but we need to start having them. We feel that everything we can do to reduce our energy consumption as a community is important. City of Columbia assisted the U.S. Department of Energy in developing the Home Energy Scores program. By adopting the proposed ordinance as part of our rental code, Columbia can continue to lead in its commitment to energy efficiency. We would like, our request is that you take this report and submit the report to city staff and ask them to use it to put together an ordinance like the one that we propose for your consideration. Questions?
Yes.
I have some comments rather than questions.
Question.
Do you want to ask questions? Because I have some comments to make.
I have a question.
Questions
too,
so go for it.
Comments too.
Questions. I have some comments as well.
Let me start. I mean,
somebody better start.
There are, I don't own any rental property, never have, but there are a lot of people in this town who do own rental property. And it's not just, the big, complexes. I mean, there are a lot of retired couples that have one duplex or two duplexes or a home in the first ward they rent to supplement their retirement. And I know some of these people, and I think this is a bigger pool of citizens than many people understand. And we've talked before about trying to figure out a way to incentivize landlords either through an open data system about, when you're renting, I'm renting a place for $300, what's the utility charge? And we really never figured out how to do that because of individual variation. But I tell you, if I was a 75-year-old retired guy with a couple of duplexes and I saw this proposal, I would actually be pretty scared because I don't know what this means. I don't know how it's measured. Does this mean if my score is 6, you shut me down? How many people are not going to comply? If you have 10% of your rental units that don't comply, you've got a real problem on your hands, and you've got a public relations problem. And the cost of retrofitting is going to be. So again, there's a lot here. It's an interesting idea. And perhaps you've just thrown it out there to start the conversation. I think what I'm going to recommend, and again, I'm sitting here for another 30 minutes or so, so it's easy for me to make recommendations, right? I think the Energy and Environment Commission should interview stakeholders. I think you should be talking to some rent owners to find out what they think. I think you're going to be surprised at the reaction that's going to come from the community, because I don't think people understand what it means to be tested, how many people pass. I mean, if I've got two duplexes, am I going to be off the market? How much is it going to cost? It's going to create an enormous amount of anxiety. I think you probably need to be a little bit more clear on what model you're talking about. Where does it work? I mean, I presume there are people who are doing this. If there are, it would be useful for, actually, I think you should come back with an amended report after having talked to stakeholders and be a little more specific to the public and to the council about what this proposal would mean, because I see the possibility of a large number of unintended consequences from this that will create a very strong backlash from a significant population of the city of Columbia.
Interestingly enough, they actually have data on the rental property for which scores are currently available in their report, and they say that a half of the rental units that were tested, 550 of them, would have surpassed the recommended standards initially, and afterwards 99% of them would have. But I agree. I was listening to this thinking, so what exactly is involved in this, and how much trouble is it going to be?
Well,
I would be interested to get more information.
Let me make a couple of comments here. I'm amongst the alumni who had chaired the Environment and Energy Commission for several years. So is Barbara Buffalo, our esteemed sustainability director, and a few others. And I'm not sure it's fair to. I think it's a good idea to collect as much data as possible and to flush this out and to talk about it. The 900-pound gorilla in this town for many years, when it comes to the difference between rental property and owner-occupied, has to do with incentivizing. You alluded to it, incentivizing energy efficiency and so on and so forth, and somehow getting some sort of index. Which even might help the rental folks with their marketing if this is a real attraction. It even boils over into the affordable housing market, because we all know that utilities and so on and so forth for inefficient properties are the ways that people get nailed for affordable housing, even if the housing is affordable. So I'm not sure it's fair to throw this on the Environment Energy Commission to suggest that they flush out all the detail. After all, this is another advisory board and commission to the city council. And the discussion about whether or not there is a particular level at which we make these decisions and so on and so forth is kind of the purview of the city council when we have before us a draft ordinance that we can really discuss that with. And that is the time at which we engage the public in terms of their this controversy. And I agree with you. I think this will be a controversy, because there is, we can't avoid controversies up here on the dais in many cases. And I think it's certainly worth discussing. But we have to have a place to start. And I think the Environment and Energy Commission gave us a place to start. I think the next step would be to draft some sort of draft ordinance to at least put this in the kind of language that we can start to have this discussion. I think that's reasonable. I don't know. I would hope that the Environment and Energy Commission would bring lots of stakeholders to the table and consider this in terms of when they put these reports forward. On the other hand, I'm not sure that's their responsibility. I think their responsibility is to put forward some of these ideas, initiate the action, and then it's up to the city council to ask the city attorney to draft a draft ordinance that we can start the conversation within the public so that we may be able to get somewhere with this 900-pound gorilla.
Are you making a motion?
Well, yeah, I would make a motion to ask the staff to consistent with the recommendations of the EEC to produce a draft ordinance that we can scrutinize and start this conversation within the public when it comes to this particular issue.
Is there a second?
I'm going to make an argument against such a thing.
Well, there's no second, so the motion fails for lack of a second, but we'll keep talking about the report now.
Well, I have two concerns. One is, we've identified some form of a problem that we have inefficient rental properties, but we don't have any clue of what we're trying to accomplish. Are we trying to get all of our rental properties within a certain
degree of efficiency? What is that degree of efficiency? How much is this going to cost? I mean, how much is this going to cost the people in the community who own rental properties? Which cost is going to be put back into the cost of the rental property, which is going to make some properties that are currently more affordable less affordable? I mean, so the ramifications of this are huge. I mean, I'm working with a family right now, and their biggest concern is just finding a place that they can get into with the credit that they have. And so, you know, we haven't really identified the people we're trying to help. Are we trying to help people of lower income, medium income, people can live in a neighborhood that maybe utilities aren't a problem to them? This just hasn't, to me, been thought out very well with all of the unintended consequences, the costs involved to city staff, property owners, more intrusion into private property rights. Now we're going to have a city that's going to micromanage your home efficiency if you're a rent landlord. Sorry, I mean, if that's exactly what it is. I hear sighs, but we can't solve every problem there is in the world, and I think that some people have to have some. There are other concerns, like I said, the families that I've worked with, just being able to get a roof over their head is primary, a bigger concern, and I'd rather help people get jobs and training and the things so that they're not in that predicament. And that's how I would approach some of these problems, is have better opportunities for employment, training, and get these families out of the circumstances that they're in. And so
on the financial analysis, I think it's important to think in terms of payback time. And if an initial investment in energy efficiency results in a reduction in monthly utility bills, then there's a certain time point at which you break even, after which you're then saving money. If that payback time is pretty short, it's a very good investment.
But can we tell how long the average person rents a property?
It's not related to an individual person.
Payback would be.
The landlord presumably will pay for the energy efficiency improvement and will then raise the rent to cover that, but the utility bills will be less, and overall there'll be a savings between the landlord and the many tenants.
Yeah, so I think that's a fair point, but I agree with the mayor that we need more information, and I think we need stakeholder engagement, and I think it should come before we draft the ordinance rather than after. This is reminiscent of the plastic bag ordinance, which I'm troubled by the 50 million plastic bags that get generated within the city of Columbia. But what was the result of that? It was a painful public discussion, and the state stripped away our rights to regulate. I look in my crystal ball, if we move forward with an ordinance and draft it and have consternation from landlords, they have reach into Jefferson City. And also, I mean, the mayor's point about just how many small rental places. It's a cottage industry in Columbia to buy a place and rent to college students. So I think, we're more likely to move forward with something that actually happens. Our decisions can be overturned from top or the bottom. And even out of goodwill, we can't get too far ahead of the citizenry. And the best way to kind of know where citizenry is to engage stakeholders. And I think Energy and Environment Commission would be a great place to do that. If we would have taken a more slower and deliberative process with plastic bags, I don't think we would have had the unfortunate outcome that we ended up with.
Just a comment here. You do all realize that we had several interns that looked into this issue, filed a report about 2 or 3 years ago with respect to this, what I have characterized as a 900-pound gorilla. If you'd ask Barbara Buffalo about this, there was a report filed about bringing stakeholders to the table. This was not even within the context of the Environment Energy Commission, but it was in the context of interns serving the city staff that looked into this idea of energy efficiency and the possibilities of increased efficiencies, both for rental property and for owner-occupied property. So it's not as if we're approaching this from without any information whatsoever. This is not a new deal. This is a continuing discussion. And I think it's appropriate to carry this discussion into the public arena from the City Council's perspective, because I think it's really important, even in terms of of affordable housing and how that relates to energy efficiency and utility bills. Yes, it's going to be controversial, no question about it. And we ought to attack that controversy and discuss it. But just sending it back for more information, I'm not opposed to more information. I think we ought to have it. We ought to have the information in a public forum, and we ought to talk about it and come to some conclusions. But I'm not in favor of just kicking this can down the road like we've been doing for the last 10 years.
Any other comments? I view this as informational, and I think it's a controversy that I think we'll be hearing from constituents one way or the other.
No doubt.
And I think it's useful to put it in the arena. And so we're done. The next report is an update on the development code project. It's largely informational, but staff, you may present relevant facts.
Yeah, we'd like to move ahead with the public process of consideration by the Planning and Zoning Commission, and we envision a number of meetings to get that done, all the while accommodating the Planning and Zoning Commission's normal caseload. So I think we have a strategy for getting several public hearings in. That would also give the public multiple opportunities to get on record with questions, concerns, comments, and suggestions. And also gives us time to plan a number of exhibits to convey information that is important to the public and provide notices. In the case of our downtown district, we will notify all the property owners because the conversion of C2 to the form-based code really does take on the proportions of a zoning map change, because it's a new kind of way of mapping the property with some different regulations that we haven't had before in the downtown area. So for all those reasons, we're proposing this schedule to you to have several meetings over the months of May and June, and tentatively get a break in there that would enable us to prepare a report on behalf of the Planning and Zoning Commission over late summer, and then get the code to you sometime around September.
Well, real quick, I know I've had some comments from people that are concerned with some of the new codes that specifically deal with downtown properties. So have you, so are people being encouraged to write their concerns down? I know we have had the conversations with the consultants in some public meetings. But I think one of the comments was addressed to me is like, you know, how am I going to come before the city council and I'm going to have 3 minutes to share my concerns over an issue this big? And so I think they're looking at how are they as a constituent going to be able to adequately address and express in that short time frame. Is there going to be time where we're going to get together and hear longer conversations from people that are maybe directly impacted, or what are we envisioning?
Yeah, and I won't address how the council conducts its business, because that, of course, will be up to you. But I think one of the things we can suggest to our commission is that we do some kind of advance solicitation of interest in speaking at a particular meeting. So in other words, ask folks if they would like to register some comments, get a sense of how much time they might need, whether they're speaking on behalf of a group, and that sort of thing. And that's something that I could suggest to work around the issue of having a very large document and limiting folks to just very short comments. The other suggestion is to put detailed comments in writing, and we'd forward those to the commission, but the oral comments would be kept relatively brief, and we'd ask speakers to just address highlights in their comments. So I think there's some ways to manage that.
And just, I'm going to bring up, just because I know we've had several issues that are this magnitude, we've had separate council meetings just devoted to this issue. So I would highly recommend that moving forward, even if we have to take one or two, maybe a special council meeting, because this is a massive undertaking, and I don't think it would do it justice to try and do have these conversations amongst every other issue we have in the city.
Mm-hmm. It's my experience, 6 years on the council. This is a 300-page document, right?
That's correct, yeah.
It's my experience that the closer you get to midnight, the more concerns pop up.
Oh, sure.
And that's going to be the biggest challenge. And it's just human nature. People will get progressively more intensely involved as you get to the end of the road, and it will get hotter and hotter. And so I wish you all the best.
Well, sure. But I also think your suggestion is a wonderful suggestion. I mean, I think we need to dedicate. This is such a big deal. This is really a change, such a big change, or potentially a big change, depending on the conversation, that we need to really offer people more than just 3 minutes to come up to the dais to give their opinion. And I think we need to have a separate dedicated meeting, or maybe more than one. The same kind of thing. You know, I didn't turn out as well as I expected the last time we had a meeting when it came to your issue, the power line issue. You know, I thought we would have a meeting to get more information. If there was no new information, we'd move forward. It didn't turn out that way. But I think it was worth letting the folks have their say, and regardless of how it turned out, this is another one of those cases, and I think we have to really seriously consider that.
I'd like to bring up a comment. What I've heard from people is that they're concerned about how this code is going to go forward and how it's going to be used. And I saw that you had looked at some test cases, and that's in the recommendation, but are there any plans besides that 1 4-hour meeting to actually meet with citizens to explain this code, as opposed to expecting them to understand this code well enough to come and give us a 3-minute opinion? You know, are there more information or neighborhood meetings planned, or information meetings from your department before the public hearings in front of planning and zoning, something that will allow people more information so that they know whether they need to object or not?
Yes, the one thing that we don't have in the schedule that's in the report is that we have built into our regular planning and zoning schedule is we have public information meetings on Tuesdays. At minimum, we dedicate those as well to the development code update so folks could just drop in. And really, it's for a project of this scale, it's really just so they can engage us in the conversation about what concerns them or what they want to know about. We wouldn't operate on the pretense that we're explaining the whole code each one of those Tuesdays, but it would really just to inform them, well, we've got an upcoming hearing, and here's what we're going to be doing at that hearing. Now tell us, what is it that you'd like to know more about? And I think what may come out of that is we do some kind of special engagement meetings, but we didn't really want to over-program this with, every other Wednesday or something, we're going to have yet another meeting on it. We probably should get a sense of what people really want to hear more about outside of the hearing structure, and I think we can accommodate that.
Another question real quick. I know that the CID is performing their own test studies.
That's correct, yeah.
And how will this schedule coordinate with that? I think that, in all due fairness, that since they're putting up their own money to study it from an independent, somewhat neutral platform, I think it would be best that we hear the outcome of that as well and compare it to how our test studies turned out as well and see if there's any discrepancies and work through those discrepancies before we get to a public hearing component, because I don't think that's where we really want to solve those issues.
Yeah, and I think what I'd ask is that when we start the hearing process, if the CID could make that request that there be some time allowed to present results of those tests. That'd be something the Planning and Zoning Commission could consider at one of its early meetings. That'd be a suggestion I'd offer. But I think the timeline they're talking about would wrap that project before the ordinance comes to you. So you'd at least have the benefit of those results. But so whether it's something that the P&Z is asked to consider, I'd ask that they just make that request if that's what they want to do.
So that they should take the initiative?
At least that's what
I'd
suggest.
Okay.
So let me just interject. One of the ways that the staff came up with to try to take smaller bites, right, because you try to, this is too big to handle at one sitting.
And that's a good idea.
There are five P&Z meetings plan. So we chunk it up into five smaller bites to try to get focus around those issues. So there will be, you know, if someone's interested in the whole thing, they can come to all five meetings. If there's just one piece that's really the most concern, they can economize their time a little bit. So that's one way we're trying to accommodate that very topic. But one thing we didn't throw on here, and we can, is some pre-council work. And then, of course, the number of meetings you want to have is totally up to you. We're here for your use. So that's we'll add a couple of at least 1 2-hour session, or maybe a couple 1-hour sessions or something like that in the back of this, and then we'll see where you want to go at that point. There's no rush. There's no deadline. So that's the great part. Everyone can feel comfortable to a certain degree before.
One kind of natural deadline is until we do that, then our old code remains in place. So, I mean, I look at the 10-story building at 9th and Locust that wouldn't have been allowed under the new code, because I think they put a 6-story cap on 9th Street. So I would just caution people who feel that there aren't enough protections for downtown to not delay the process, because until we do, you know, the old code, you know, with the interim C2 rules still apply. So, you know, I think we do want to take in public input and move through deliberately. And, you know, I don't think we could have brought it forward any quicker than we could have, because there would have been an unholy alliance of people who felt it was too restrictive for business and people who felt it wasn't enough protections for neighborhoods, and we would have got crushed. So we have to win over one of the sides, at least, you know, and a consensus would be great. But I've been around long enough to see that those are hard to come by.
That's a great point, Mike. And, you know, this whole thing about it kind of reminds me of land disturbance processes when you start talking about tree preservation ordinances, and there is an impending deadline at which time things change. And then all of a sudden you see tree harvesting occur. You know, and in some ways, everybody tries to get into the market legitimately with the rules that exist. That's for sure. I do take some umbrage by some of the accusations that we have moved the goalposts, if you will. All of that was legitimate, and those goalposts, we didn't take anyone's rights away. We just imposed a few more. I wouldn't even call them restrictions, but a few more issues that receive more scrutiny when it comes to building over 10 stories, for example, or whatever it is that we're doing. But those are all legitimate ordinances, and it's up to people to pay attention to the law. But yes, you're right, and it probably troubles me that the longer and we've had a few delays, not that they were unreasonable delays. I think this stuff takes time, and it's a very frustrating part of government to understand that these things happen incrementally, and it takes probably twice as long as you think it takes to do. But in order to present this to the public and let the due process issue take effect and let people have their say, it does take time. I appreciate that. But there is also some sense of urgency now that we're so close to getting these recommendations, that we really need to get this out there in front of the public, get them engaged, get that conversation going, and get these changes made.
Any other comments? I skipped 30. Report 30, which is trail improvements at Forum at the MKT, funded by a donation from the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, Columbia Lodge number 207. And I think the citizens thank this organization for its contribution. This falls under the criteria allowing administrative on the process of the administrative public improvements, which does not require council action. So it's a $15,000 project. Unless there is objection, staff will move forward with this. 32 is interdepartmental transfer of funds request. Are there any questions or comments? We'll move to general comments by the public. I will yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wants to speak about anything.
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Rangeline. I have often stood up here and spoke on several different things over the last 6 years. Tonight, the energy subject, I would sure like to see the city probably adopt some of the ideas that come from Boone Electric. In those incentives, they have an annual meeting of energy saving ideas, like a fair, just that one topic of energy saving ideas. There are money rebates, purchase this item and get it a money kickback and a medium of whatever it is our ultimate goal of reduction of energy. Rather than seeing more and more higher rates, is there any incentives that the city could possibly offer with a little money behind it where you help the landlord step up and get on board because they can use it for a tax write-off? Under safety, this is very important this very day. I worked at the EB Chance Company for over 13 and a half years, and on every month we'd have a safety meeting. I have mentioned it only once here at the city. I understood you were having lots of accidents on the garbage pickup side. There are many times in this old world we have to forget, stop and remember how young some people are. Do I lift that object with my legs or do I bend my knees and lift it? There are all kinds of little things that we take for granted as we get older. On this day, I parked on South 10th. I was on the west side. I had to walk around the brand new construction at 10th and Locust. As I walk down the street, I'm attending a funeral at Missouri United Methodist Church, volunteer of nursing home services. She apparently played piano over 8 different locations here in the city. Upon leaving the funeral, it's getting to be about 12:30. I've now crossed the street. I'm headed up the east side of 10th. And unbeknownst to me, after crossing the street, I hit what would be the leg of a metal leg of a sign that has been placed on the sidewalk. I flew several feet, never rolled, but I've been in 2 chiropractors this very day. And what I need to know is who do I speak to at the city? And as the people earlier were addressing, what do you need to update around work sites? I'm a victim today. That's a brand new construction at 10th and Locust. And can somebody answer the question, who would I approach?
We'll have staff contact you. Can you
call my office?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll move to council comments. Let's start with Ward 1. Anything, Ward 1? Ward 2?
Don't forget to vote tomorrow.
Ward 3?
I just have a couple of things. One is the issue of Patriot Place came up, and there are some folks on this panel that have done yeoman's work when it comes to veterans, homelessness, and so on. That's the first step, and that certainly is a remarkable project. I think everybody can take pride in it. I'm just fortunate that I was an early advocate of that project, and it also happens to be in the Third Ward. It purports to be a tremendous asset for this community, and I hope we can move on beyond homeless veterans, to encompass. We've had some conversations about tiny houses. There's going to be a demonstration project and so on in the near future to talk about that in conjunction with the farmers market and so on and so forth. So stay tuned for all of that. I think there's some good things coming. Consistent with the strategic plan, it was talking about dealing with some of the underserved in our community. I think that's a very positive step forward, and it's something that we should take very seriously. The other is to endorse what you just said. I've been kind of preoccupied since I'm running for office. Tomorrow is election day. Get out there, folks. This is really important. We need to have as big a turnout as possible. This is your stake in it. It doesn't get any better than this in terms of democracy. The rubber meets the road when it comes to local elections. I have to thank the mayor for my collaboration with the mayor. He's been doing this for about 6 years, and I've been either helping or not helping him for three of those 6 years. But you gotta tip your hat to anybody who does this, particularly at that level. And thank you for doing that. You are, however, a lot easier to get along with now that you've decided to retire than you were before. But nonetheless, get out here. There's a mayor's race out here. There's two incumbent races. Tomorrow is voting day. Participate by all means. That's all I have.
Ward 4?
Nothing from me.
5?
I would just like to know why the trash compactor was moved when the gentleman came and spoke earlier this evening.
I'll have to look into that.
I know it's always a difficult thing. You know, we have people who want to live in an urban area and live in a downtown, but then with downtown living comes downtown noise. But yeah. We want to have people living in peace with each other, so we have a duty to remove trash, but we want to have happy residents in the downtown too. So I can have that little background information, it would be most helpful.
Continual battle between property owners wanting us off their land and then begging us back on, and what they'll allow us to put there. And I don't know if that has any role in this case, but we will look into it and get
back to
you.
Okay, thank you.
Ward 6?
Over here, and no.
Nope. There you go. Move.
I know where it was.
Let me say that I would like my councilman's cell phone so that I can keep him assessed of snow removal in the future.
By the way, I don't have one, but my wife has a cell phone. It's 999-3467, and you can call at any time, and I will get the message.
I do have one brief thing. I met with Corey Ridenour, who's representing Cascades community. They have a little swimming pool, and he asked me, and I can't answer this question, and so staff really probably needs to answer it. They have a swimming pool. They used to have a $14 sewer fee. They have two toilets and two sinks, and they don't, the water evaporates from the pool. I mean, it didn't go into the sewer. And they got upgraded to commercial at $600 a month, that's what he said. And it doesn't make sense to me. I'm sure there's a reason. But if staff could...
I can forward you that report. I'll happily do it.
Okay.
I was going to say, I think we have that handy. So.
Okay, good. Well, I don't know why you talked to me.
They don't like the answer I gave.
Oh, okay. Very good. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.